Listen to RN Music Shows on demand. abc.net.au/RN.
Hi there, you're with Big Ideas on RN via podcast and on the ABC Radio mobile app. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for joining me. Does Australia need more ratbags, more outliers, loners, people prepared to shake the place up? Australian dot-com millionaire, philanthropist and provocateur Graham Wood thinks we do, and he's our guest on Big Ideas tonight. Graham Wood is an entrepreneur and the founder of What If, the online travel booking website. He made a lot of money out of this venture, and he now gives a lot of his money away. He's helped bankroll election campaigns for the Australian Greens. He's donated to universities, set up his own online newspaper, helped bring the Guardian newspaper to Australia. He supports music and the arts and is a passionate environmentalist. Graham Wood is planning to turn a former woodchip mill in Tryabunna on Tasmania's east coast into an eco-tourist resort. So he's not your ordinary businessman. In fact, he's critical of neoliberals and free trade, of endless growth, of measuring the economy using GDP, and he believes rampant consumerism is destroying the environment. If we want to create a sustainable, innovative future for Australia, we need, Graham Wood believes, to tap into people power via digital and social media. Last week, Graham Wood was at the State Library of Queensland, where he delivered the 2015 Griffith Review Lecture.
How do you tell a ratbag when you've actually seen one? How do you know a ratbag has been somewhere? Now, they don't stand out. They're not dressed like anarchists or Marxists or anybody with an "ist" after their name. You can tell them by, there are a number of key traits. The first is they are outliers. They are not part of the mainstream. You won't find them wandering with the herd. They are not loners, but they separate themselves. They like to have a position where they can observe what's going on and pounce when the time is right. They are destabilisers. They like to mess things up. Anything that reeks of conformism, orthodoxy, status quo, they are just targets for your ratbag. They empathise with people. They feel others' pain. They feel the injustices of others. Now, they are also altruistic, but the real ratbag doesn't like the term altruistic because it sounds a little preachy and a little moralistic. And the main point is they really do enjoy what they do. They have a lot of fun. They enjoy it so much they can't stop doing it. Now, there are two other words that kind of fit into this scenery. One is activist and the other is entrepreneur. And I could have described either of those in my definition of a ratbag. The difference with an activist is the last point. They are not light and bright. They enjoy things when a campaign goes well, but in the normal course of events, there's a lot of angst about them. They're waving placards or punching the air with their fist or shouting. And when you see photos of them, their beards have got spittle on it. Entrepreneurs often start out as ratbags because think about their outliers, their thinkers, they're altruistic, they have fun. Now, the trouble with entrepreneurs, especially in the for-profit business, is that some of those things tend to slip away over time. Success is a danger for the ratbag become entrepreneur, because once a business grows and the money's coming in, it's not any fun anymore. So when the fun goes out, then the money becomes the goal. And the more the money becomes the goal, the less you care about those friendly little consumers that you used to know personally. Now they're in the database, they're numbers. They're being sliced and diced and analysed to see how much money you can make out of them. So the really successful entrepreneur in dollar terms eventually moves over to the dark side and then sets himself up to be torn apart by the next generation of ratbag. Now, my journey, long journey into ratbaggery and activism, started as a child in Brisbane. My parents lived at Sherwood. We lived on the wrong side of the tracks. My parents were good working people, hard workers, conservative, pretty boring, really. But living at Sherwood gave me the opportunity, and I had a motorbike, a push bike. I'm a primary school kid at this stage. And myself and others would get on our bikes and ride to the Brisbane River near the mouth of Oxley Creek. Now, in those days, there was a lovely little sandy beach on the river. Oxley Creek was this pristine, wonderful wilderness to us. At that age, we thought the whole world must be like this, surely. We could catch fish any time we went down there, and we could take the fish home and eat them. We could catch mud crabs and take them home and eat them, and play in the trees and watch the birds and have all those idyllic, childish things going on. My other favourite was Moreton Island, where there's a bit of fishing in my background, you can tell. Moreton Island, we would go, and on the surf side of Moreton Island, there were schools of sea mullet and schools of tailor. On the Moreton Bay side, this beautiful long beach was full of fish. You could go and fish for half an hour and get a bag full. Flathead, whiting, brim, you name it. The sky was full, not full, but there were lots of sea eagles. And the birds that came seasonally, that walked around, birds on big legs, walked around the mud flats, it was just another pristine wilderness to me as a kid. This is where I started to develop a love of nature. Then something began to change. On Moreton Island, the fish started to disappear. And some of the rarer birds would go away for a season and not return, or return in smaller numbers. Oxley Creek, when I went back there much later, well, I noticed we used to walk around in the mud to catch mud crabs. You couldn't really do that because you went home and you smelt and your mother would go crook at you, because there was a lot of industrial development going on up the creek. Eventually, Oxley Creek became a smelly industrial drain. Moreton Island, the life just seemed to go out of it. The only way I can describe it is that it went quiet. The life just wasn't there anymore. So that was the beginning of my life as an environmentalist.
Entrepreneur, environmentalist and philanthropist Graham Wood on Big Ideas on RN and online. Next in his lecture, he takes aim at neoliberals, who he's renamed uber-liberals.
The neoliberal is a term that doesn't kind of gel, I think, in our language here. So I'd like to label neoliberals uber-liberals. They're about as far as you can get from Uber, but I like the mix. They love free markets. Love them. a free market to them is anything they can do at their freedom at the cost of everyone else. What I'm doing here is showing you why we're entering, we are already in the golden age for ratbaggery. But it's important to understand what those opportunities are. A market, as any first-year economics student understands, is defined by buyers and sellers. If you get willing buyers and willing sellers exchanging, there's a market. The Uber libs have discovered nice ways to distort those markets in the public arena. By reducing taxes, that means they can't pay for stuff. So people who want consumers, who want healthcare services or education, suddenly start paying for those services by themselves. That's clever. We're heroes because we reduced taxation. And look, everyone likes to do it. And all of our friends like to buy the schools and run private education experiences. That goes a certain distance. The other side of that is markets are free for either the buyer or the seller to exert influence. If they're good at exerting influence one way, then you, the consumer, have the power to exert influence the other way. Martin mentioned the Tribunna wood chip mill in his introduction. The first time I saw Tribunna and that gigantic wood chip pile, I felt ill. It just seemed so unnatural and such a silly thing to do on that magnificent east coast of Tasmania. Now, those wood chips were chipped from old growth forests, and I like old growth forests. They're lovely places. So a combination of those factors and the dislike of old growth forests caused a few people I know to go and talk to the consumers of the paper products that were produced ultimately from that old growth forest. To cut a long story short, they convinced them to stop buying paper products that came from old growth forest. That led to the demise of the Tribunna wood chip mill. It didn't make sense anymore. So they put it on the market. There was another group backed by, let's say, the forces of evil, who were trying to get some money together through the government. And I was away I was walking in the Bungle Ranges with a sat phone, and I could only talk on the sat phone when the satellites went between the gaps of the gorges. So this was a very messed up sort of conversation. But it turned out that there was another dangerous feral like me who was willing to put up some money to buy it and snap it from under the nose of the enemy. I agreed in 5 minutes, and we bought it. That was fun, and now we're turning it into what it should be, an eco-tourism resort and supporting tourism on the East Coast. The moral of that story is there is power in the consumer's hands that really needs to be exercised, not just by ratbags but by everyone, but the more ratbags out there finding different ways to upset the system, the better. So I'm here to promote ratbaggery tonight. If free markets are the god for the Uber libs, then consumerism is their religion. What they've successfully done is conflate quality of life with quality of product bought and quantity of product bought. They've convinced aspiring middle-class consumers to buy more and more and more and chuck away more and more and more. They've made brands a life support system for us so that if we don't buy the brands that make our teeth whiter or our hair nicer or our armpits smelling nicer or the cars we drive don't look right and all of the rest of it, then it pretty much limits your chance to get laid, number one. And there are all the other problems that follow, the lack of confidence and everything else that flows from that. Now, there's a couple of problems with consumerism. Number one, if we all consume at the rate, the whole world, if the whole world consumed at the rate of consumption per capita of the average North American, we would need five planets to provide all that food and all that stuff and build all those fridges and make those cars. How do I know it's five? Well, it's based on science, you know, that old-fashioned thing. Even if I'm wrong, say it's six or three or two, it's a problem because there's more than one. Even today, we are consuming resources of this planet at the rate of about 1.5 planets a year. Ah, and apart from that, we've got this thing that some people call global cooling. Now, it's actually the other, stupid, which is reducing the opportunity to do all those things. So consumerism in its current form simply won't work, just on those physical facts themselves. Now, imagine you're looking at a graph. See the red line? That's the timeline. And on the vertical, so that goes back, let's say, 40,000 years, because that's about when Aborigines turned up in Australia, we think, 50. Adrian will put me right on this. And the vertical are the number of people on the planet. So it goes bump, 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 along, bump, bump, bump. If we take the last 200 years, we're talking about the Industrial Revolution thereon. So there's a tiny little peak. So 200 years out of, say, 40,000 years, that's 0.5% of the length of that line. Now, that says for all that time, civilization has progressed pretty happily. What kept that civilization together? How did life make meaning for them? I think there are simple answers to that. They treated each other as individuals. They allowed individuals to have autonomy. They treated them as part of a community. When they contributed to the community, they were acknowledged for that. They all had their own competencies, and they were acknowledged for that. They understood relationships, relationship with the self, with nature, with others, and the spiritual. So that basic set of instinctive values, intrinsic values perhaps, have served humanity pretty well for 95%, well, 100%. It still works. Here's my point. It still works. Now, this last little blip, the things that drive, that motivate us to go out and be good consumers, are not the nicest things. They're greed and envy and egos. They're not the base, solid, what makes life meaningful to us factors. Now, you saw Adrian Barragubba up here a minute ago. I want to tell a story about Adrian and his people. He mentioned he was taken off the land, his people were taken off the land about 100 years ago and dispersed up and down the East Coast. Even though they were removed from the land, they never lost the spiritual connection with that land. Adrian plays a didgeridoo. I'm sorry he didn't bring it here tonight. And if he doesn't mind me saying, does it pretty tough as a didge player and as a traditional dancer. Now, about a year or so, maybe 18 months ago, he had a knock on the door, figuratively, from a Mr. Adani. Mr. Adani is standing there with his bevy of solicitors. Mr. Adani is a very, very rich man. and his solicitors live in one of those towers over there. You know, they're doing all right. And Mr. Adani said, Adrian, mate, lovely country you've got out there, but even lovelier is all this coal that's buried under it. I want to dig it up. And if you will cooperate with me and hand your rights over to me, I will give you and your people, say, $60 million, over the life of the project. Now, $60 million, there's a fair bit of consumption to be had, must have sounded pretty attractive. A lot of Adrian's people live on the breadline. A lot of their kids don't get into high school. So that, I would have thought, must have been a bit of a challenge for him. As a whitey trying to understand the spiritual connection of the Aboriginal people to their land, I've got an insight, and it's something I value a great deal. But what Adrian did was to talk to his people about it. Some said, ah, give me the money and let's run. But the majority decision was, no, tell them to bugger off, which Adrian did. And he liked that. That's a lot of fun. That's why he's a ratbag. Now, he then put together a campaign to take his message around the world to major financiers, the big banks, UBS, Citibank, Standard Chartered, Bank of America. Adrian and a couple of his mates went along to talk to them, simply to tell their story and explain his spiritual connection to the country and how that would be destroyed if this project went ahead. He went into all of these boardrooms with his didgeridoo, sat down in the corner. After, he said, do you mind if I play the didge? So he sat down in the corner and played the didge. Now, whether that broke him up, who knows? But we had several of those banks who later signed to say, we will stay away from the financing of this project. So there's an example where this basic meaning of life to Adrian and his people outweighed the consumer drive. So all of that time, all of those people have understood this and lived this kind of life. So it's not impossible. Give you another example. El Sistema in Venezuela. 1975, this guy, there were kids everywhere, sleeping in rubbish dumps, scrimmaging around to do whatever they can. Really, really poor kids. He decided he would start an orchestra. He got the kids together to find the rubbish to build the instruments. It's been a huge success. They did not have any real... There was no question about, do I go and buy an iPod or do I build a bass out of a empty drum and a few bits of timber? But once they got going, this gave them a sense of community. They were brought together with a common cause. It's become a very famous model. I believe there are orchestras, El Sistema type orchestras, in about 100 countries. They, I believe, are reacting to those same basic instincts. They have meaning in their lives. They are enjoying what they're doing. Jose, whatever his name is, was clearly a ratbag when he kicked that one off. Just one more example. Anna Goldsworthy, pianist, author, quotes her long-standing music teacher, Eleonora Savan, I think it is, who lived in Russia in Stalinist times. Eleonora says, of those times, when materialism isn't an option, all sorts of things flourish. And if you think about the intensity and the feeling that comes out of Russian composers, you can sense how that actually happens. In my own experience, I've had an organisation called What Opera. What Opera takes a couple of opera professionals, sends them to a high school, gets 20 volunteers, and in 24 contact hours, gets them to write their own opera from scratch. Your story, your music, your characters, off you go. There are a couple of rules, you know, no sex, no swearing. We do four schools together in a region at the time, and we always choose a mix of rich and poor schools. So the private rich schools and the English as second language schools come up with vastly different results. Nothing will surprise you here. The kids from the rich schools are very polished and professional because they're all getting private tuition. And the stories they tell, I swear, are the stories that their parents want to hear and their teachers want to hear. The English as second language, some of these kids can hardly speak English. The stories they tell are raw and powerful. It's about the difficulties in their lives, the loss of family members, the struggle they had to get to Australia, the struggle they have to assimilate themselves and their families into the community. Now, when we look at the stories of transformation that come out of these schools, inevitably the bulk, the majority, 95% of them come from those poor schools because they've been given the chance to get involved in a community, all the ratbaggy kind of things. They've been seen as competent, they've been recognised, they grow enormously. They are much more likely to go to the local drama society and say, put their hand up, can I please come and join your group? Can I learn more about this? Can I play an instrument? So in, say, Sydney, I know where the majority of ratbags are going to come from in the next 10 to 15 years. It ain't going to be the eastern suburbs. One of the prime targets for ratbags is is organisations or even whole industries who conform. Conforming in the arts is a pretty dangerous thing because everything becomes the same. And because of the power of consumerism, even major companies fall into the consumer trap. Spectacle becomes important, and spectacle is a slippery slide. Now, I like Opera Australia, and I think Lyndon Terracini's a wonderful chap. But their lurch into spectacular, having elephants swimming across the harbour or whatever they do down there, seems like it can't go on forever. It's like the next opening ceremony for the next Olympic Games. They just keep ramping it up all the time. So the impact of consumerism on the arts generally, and the Writers' Festival thing. Tell me what's different about the Writers' Festival from here to Sydney to Perth to anywhere. They're formulaic. They're getting boring. So potential ratbags among you in the arts, you've got a big job to do. The real point to all of this is that all of those meaningful values, those motivations that I talked about, are within all of us. That means to me we are all potential ratbags. Now, what can I do if I want to be a ratbag, you're asking me? If you want to use your consumer power, well, every dollar you spend can change the course of history, especially if you and all your mates do the same thing. By buying the good and not buying the bad, by not buying at all, if you keep your wallet in your pocket, it means maybe you take a bit of time off your day job to allow you to go and do the things you really love and are motivated for through those inner senses, through those basic drives that you have, and not driven by the little peaky thing over here, which is going to go away. Sorry about that, everyone who sells something here, as long as it's selling something good. So I commend to you, there are things you can do in your pajamas before you get out of bed. You can change suppliers from clean energy, from dirty energy to clean energy. You can decide not to spend, not to renovate the kitchen. Or if you want to buy something that will last, that is sustainable, that you're not going to throw away.
You're with Big Ideas on RN, online and on the ABC radio app. I'm Paul Barclay. And that was entrepreneur, environmentalist and philanthropist Graham Wood delivering the 2015 Griffith Review Lecture. Let's return to the State Library of Queensland now. Graham Wood had a conversation with me after his lecture. I asked him firstly how we could encourage more people to be ratbags or outliers.
Well, they'll do it themselves if they get bored so witless that there's got to be a better life. Mm. The problem of conformity, and this goes back to the conservative push, is to eliminate risk. Our former Prime Minister, I remember carrying on with great delight about zillions of money being given to the Bureau of Meteorology to be able to build a much smarter, bigger, stronger weather modelling system. So instead of predicting that the eastern suburbs of Brisbane might get rain, a 90% chance of rain, it could come down to the soccer field where your kid is playing and say, it will rain at 9:35 this morning. Now, that takes a lot of uncertainty out of life, but it also takes a lot of fun out of life. Mm. So over-predictability and over-confirmation to orthodoxy is so boring.
You get crippled, really, don't you? Because you can't act unless you have the information to prove that something's definitely going to happen. If you can't get that information, you just sit around not doing much at all. It seems to be the sort of ingrained way in which we've been taught to think, rather than just going out there and having a go and ignoring the people who say to you, oh, that's never going to work.
Well, have we been taught to think in our education system? Or
conform.
Or have we regurgitated stuff that they've stuffed down our throat and we've answered the question and walk out the door and cannot think?
So you shoot some of the blame home to the inadequacies or the limitations of our education system?
Well, it's the approach to education. I think the approach that Australia has is not as enlightened as other countries, Scandinavian countries. We pay our teachers and lecturers peanuts. Peanuts?
It strikes me that we live in an age where being a ratbag or an agent provocateur should be easier, because the digital world, social media, we can get out there and we can send our message out there, we can connect with people, we can form groups of people online, common interests. But on the other hand, those entrenched interests of status quo are also using those exact means to beat up fear of change. So on the one hand, you've got all that activity happening in social media, but you've got all of these people using that same sort of vehicle to block change. How do you think we get around that?
Well, I think you're talking about the conservative press, and I'm sure you're not targeting any one individual here, Paul. Someone who owns,
Far be it for me to target any individual.
Never. But individuals like that tend to operate in their own echo chamber, and they tend to be naive at social media, and they tend to be way behind in the latest and greatest. So the agile young ratbag with friends can always be a step ahead. And I love that.
There's real potential there, you think.
It's happening.
Yeah. Any examples that you can think of?
No.
It's always hard when you get put on the spot like that, isn't it?
Yes, I can. So that fine chap, Mr. Harper, who just lost his job in Canada, I'm aware there was a campaign over there that was very soundly based on the latest technology, on very clever, cut-through, funny and serious videos. And Canada apparently is a very conservative market, so to stand apart in the Canadian market wasn't all that hard. Because they'd been suppressed by three terms of a very conservative government. And that's, look, I've got conservative friends, you know. Yep. They're not all bad. Well, I know a couple. So conservatism begets conformism, begets boredom, begets lack of excitement to go out and change things.
What do your business colleagues, those people who work in the world of commerce and who are, as you say, on the conservative side, what do they make of someone like yourself funding the Greens Party, speaking out about not conforming? It strikes me that there are not many people in business like you in Australia.
I don't run into many. And how do they treat me?
How do they view you, even?
Well, with suspicion. Some of them need me, you know, because I'm on their board or something like that. But suspicion is the word, and wary that I might just sort of open my briefcase and throw a grenade out the window or something.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of very rich people in Australia, but we don't have a very rich culture of philanthropy to go with that. You have, as we've heard tonight, donated money to universities, to the arts, to youth, to the environment. You've bought large chunks of Tasmania's native forests. I could go on. How do we foster a greater sense of philanthropy amongst those people who have much that they could give, but choose, for whatever reason, not to?
There are two approaches. Some will never. Some will give to projects that are dressed up as not too dodgy, not too progressive, even though they are. And the third category are people with money but are part of the establishment and can't be seen to be doing it. So part of the subterfuge in operating in this environment is to have quiet meetings in dark cafes where there are no media around and not sending emails or even talking on your mobile phone, because mine's tapped for sure, right? And finding ways for them to support a good cause but not being seen to. And I totally respect their view that they've got to operate in this stilted, conservative, clubby and small business market in Australia, and it's difficult to break away from that.
So they themselves are quite progressive. It's just they don't want to be outed as such.
They don't want to be seen as such.
It's quite a bleak thought, really, isn't it? That they, in a sense, need to pretend to be more conservative than they are, because of they're fearful of the repercussions that might come of that being public knowledge.
Yes, they're not going to turn into ratbags tomorrow, Paul.
How do you see the role of the disruptive new industries, your Ubers and your Airbnbs, and the role that they've had in shaking up entrenched business in Australia? Just recently, I've heard here in Brisbane, Uber drivers are being arrested because of the impact that they're having on the taxi industry. There's even been reports of brawls breaking out between Uber drivers and taxi drivers. Do you think that's a model that we should be encouraging more of?
Absolutely.
Not the fighting.
I mean, if they didn't have a workout this morning, then a bit of a brawl outside the taxi rank, that's all right.
It shakes up the way we do business, do you think?
Of course, and business needs shaking up.
But it is interesting how those entrenched forces respond to a challenge to their conventional ways of doing things, isn't it?
No, it's not a surprise. It's very predictable. So the taxi industry or the cab charge people who rip you off if you use your credit card, they've got friends in politics at all levels. And they look after each other. The thing is, you're in the club or you're not in the club. Now, I'm not in the club. And even if I get to the front door, it's like going into the Melbourne Club or the Queensland Club. They all look the same. If you walk in with your eyes half closed, they all look the same. Mm. If you stand there with your eyes closed, they all sound the same. And if you get close enough to them, they all smell the same. It's awful.
I've spoken to you in preparation for this event, actually, and I was struck by how many of the things that you said were so subversive to the accepted notions of business and the economy in Australia. I remember you saying to me that too much economic growth is a disaster. Measuring growth by GDP is a catastrophe. These are anathema to how most people see the functioning of capitalist enterprise, the type of enterprise that in a way you've benefited from yourself.
Can I just talk about GDP for a minute?
Yep, sure.
Thank you. Here's what's wrong with GDP. So everything that's services and products are all added up for a year, and there's your GDP for the year. Cigarette sales are part of GDP. So are the healthcare services for treating the lung cancer and the lung disease and all the drugs that go into it. So higher cigarette penetration is good for GDP. Mm-hmm. Coal miners get massive subsidies from the government. That's good for GDP. So the coal that they dig that goes to the electricity generator that makes the cement, that makes the concrete to build the seawalls to protect against seawater rise, sea level rise, that's all good for GDP. Mm. So we should dig more coal out and burn more because it's good for GDP. Mm. Do you get me? Mm. What do you think of GDP now? Mm.
It's said, though, that if the economy doesn't keep growing, that we can't create jobs, that our standard of living falls and that it's the downward spiral. What is the alternative to conventional growth-based economics?
There must be a post-growth economy. There must be. We're running out of stuff, as I inferred before. Japan is an interesting case study. They've had virtually no growth, I think, since about 99, even earlier. Now, if you look at the measures of societal well-being in Japan, their health, their education, how happy are you, the happy index kind of thing, they're doing just fine. Mm. So there's a perfect case study of a post-growth economy. They've got a conservative prime minister there at the moment who's trying to, you know, pull the levers and do all that kind of stuff. I don't think it'll work. But do the people of Japan really need that, or is it simply a game country to country and political party to political party that if GDP growth is zero, my God, that's the end of the world? It means no growth. If it's negative, that's, you know, open the window, I'm jumping out. And 3% GDP is fantastic. Mm. Now, what makes up that growth? Mm. If it's doing more of the bad stuff that's destroying the world, increasing climate change and all the rest of it, that's silly. If it's positive stuff, investment in renewable energy, investment in education, more violins being made, more composers writing more music, fantastic. If sales of sheet music go up, well, you don't do that anymore, do you? It comes digitally. So it's the mix of GDP that matters. We're using this very blunt tool as a measure of economic success and political success and business success.
Mm. You mentioned earlier the Adani Carmichael coal mine in central Queensland. I think one of the biggest coal mines slated anywhere in the world, $16 billion. The federal government just reapproved, whatever that means, that coal mine. The energy minister, Josh Frydenberg, said there was a, quote, strong moral case for that mine to proceed. What was your response when I presume that you heard him say that?
Well, I did. Moral.
Strong moral case.
What does he mean by moral in that sense?
Okay, I can answer that, actually, because I didn't put the rest of it in the quotes. But he was talking there about the ability of a country like Australia to help satisfy India's energy needs and to therefore help pull more people out of poverty in a country like India through our coal.
I totally agree that there's more energy needed in India, and it should be a distributed system, not with a central distribution, and it should be solar. And it's so simple. And even if they've only got solar and one car battery to light the lights at night so the kids can read their homework, fantastic.
Mm.
All the nonsense about needing coal to save, to drag people out of poverty is just rubbish.
And what does the approval mean for the... What does the approval mean for the Indigenous groups that you've been working with in that area, one of whom opened proceedings tonight?
Yes.
You've set up, I think, a company to represent those people, and you're helping finance that enterprise, I understand. What does the approval mean for them?
It's, first of all, it's not unexpected. I don't know all of the ins and outs about why it actually happened. I think it will... Adani don't want to be seen to be beaten by people like Adrian Barragaba.
Hmm.
Adrian beats lots of people. But Mr. Adani doesn't want to be one of them. Look, it's a step along the way. But every month, every year that goes by where that thing doesn't see the light of day gives renewable energy and new policy. So the Harper-Abbott axis, I was about to say of evil, I would never say that on Radio National, about climate change has disappeared.
Mm.
So there's new hope. There are new possibilities, I think. And these things can change quickly.
Well, the Gunns pulp mill is a good example in Tasmania, isn't it, where the Gunns were insistent for many years that that pulp mill would proceed. As we now know, it didn't proceed. Do you think we will ever see that Adani coal mine actually operate in Queensland?
Well, I certainly hope not, because it will be disastrous for many things. Most of those fossil fuels need to stay in the ground if we're going to keep this temperature increase even close to 2%.
Mm.
Now, how can the Queensland government here say that it's a good thing? A good thing for whom? For the labour union that gets jobs out of it? It's a very distorted world.
Mm.
And the media, may I say, don't hold them to account for this. It's left up to the activist groups and bunches of ratbags to draw this on. Mm. That's why we need more ratbags, please.
Well, only a ratbag would help set up a newspaper, which is something that I know that you've done in the past, firstly with the Global Mail and then by helping to bring The Guardian Australia to Australia. Why are you handing money over to the media? What's your game there? Because all of a sudden you've brought greater diversity to the Australian media. We can all wake up in the morning and we can read another newspaper, another quality newspaper for free because of your generosity, essentially. What's behind that generosity?
I started the Global Mail because I was really cheesed off with the narrow and biased reporting in the mainstream media in Australia. I had high ideals. I thought, look, you know, we'll just tell the stories differently. We'll tell it how it is. They were becoming so right-leaning. Just by being in the middle, then you're a left-wing rabid feral. You know, it's not, look at me, I've got, you know, I'm normal. Now, that was going fine, but then I sensed The Guardian were looking to go global and come to Australia, and I thought, if I put money into The Guardian, they will achieve the end that I want much quicker with much more panache than I could do out of my meagre budget. And they knew how to do it. Mm. And they had Alan Rusbridger driving it, and I had the greatest respect for that man.
Mm. Yeah. And in spite of your financial generosity, you have no input at all into the editorial content
none,
of the paper?
None, Paul, none.
Look, I'll ask one final question, then we'll take some questions from the floor. As was announced in the introduction to you tonight, you're the largest single donor to a political party in Australian history. Your donation to the Greens some years ago helped fund their election campaign and resulted, I should say, in a considerable increase in their vote as well. Are you still helping the Greens out financially, and is it your intention to continue to do so?
I'm helping the Greens by staying away from them now.
Would you like to explain further what you mean by that?
Any time I'm seen talking to one of them, there's another Senate inquiry called. That's...
So you're trouble for them, are you?
I am trouble.
What do you think about the elevation of Malcolm Turnbull to the Prime Ministership? And do you think that it has resulted in a changing of the political temperature in Australia and perhaps even a more positive atmosphere politically in Australia?
All of the above. You could feel it the next day. Incredulity, is that the right word? Mm. Has it happened? Yes, it has. I still remember even 2 days later when listening to Radio National, of course, somebody said, and the Prime Minister, and I sort of flinched because I thought, oh no, I don't want to hear that guy again, but it was Malcolm.
Entrepreneur Graham Wood, founder of What If, environmentalist and philanthropist. Last week, he delivered the 2015 Griffith Review Lecture at the State Library of Queensland. That's it for tonight. Don't forget you can listen to Big Ideas whenever you want by subscribing to our podcasts at abc.net.au/rn. Just follow the prompts to Big Ideas. And you can give us your thoughts on tonight's discussion or any discussion by posting a comment online. Hope you can join me again tomorrow. I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.
Is virtual reality on the cusp of a golden age?
There's been a huge input of funds into VR companies, and what that reflects is the technology's kind of caught up with the promise.
It's even being used in the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder.
PTSD is a really tough nut to crack, and it does appeal to some folks, whereas talk therapy wouldn't.
VR for PTSD. That's Future Tense. Download the program from the RN website, find us via the ABC Radio app, or look for us on iTunes.